Welcome back. This is section 5 in the series on the Bible. And in today's presentation, I'm going to continue commenting on some of the Christian teachings that are found in the Apostles' Creed. In the last section, we discussed the topic of resurrection, and it was shown that in the writings of Peter and Paul, resurrection is always in spirit, always in spirit. That when Jesus, quote, died in the flesh, Jesus was raised in the spirit. Now, there are certainly other viewpoints held in some of the various churches and denominations of Christianity. Obviously, they have problems with these kind of interpretations. And this is something that they will have to reconcile. It's something that they will have to decide why the teachings of their church doesn't agree with Peter and Paul. One of the problems that Baha'is are going to have to learn to address is the fact that there is at least one other statement in the New Testament which states that Jesus, after his resurrection, was raised in the flesh. Was raised in the flesh. And this actually has become the primary focus of modern-day churches when discussing resurrection. This statement, which gives a fleshly interpretation of the resurrection of Jesus, is found in the 24th chapter of the Gospel of Luke. And in the 24th chapter of the Gospel of Luke, we are told that the resurrected Christ told his disciples, quote, "A spirit hath not flesh and bones as you see me have." That's in Luke 24:39. Anuma, in the original Greek, does not have flesh or sark as you see me have. Now, apparently this passage is saying that Jesus was resurrected in the flesh, in flesh and bone, and not in spirit. Now, this is the exact opposite of what Peter and Paul taught. And nevertheless, this passage has become one of the primary reasons why some people have chosen to interpret Jesus' resurrection in a literal, fleshly way. How can this contradiction be explained? Now, while there doesn't appear to be anything else in the Gospel of Luke which contradicts Peter and Paul, there also doesn't seem to be any scriptural explanation for this discrepancy. Now, was this statement originally intended to be interpreted literally? Or was it another one of the symbolic references to the, quote, body of Christ, the congregation of Christians? Whatever the reason, if this passage is taken literally, then it clearly contradicts Peter and Paul. Both interpretations can't be right. So which one should we accept? I guess what you have to do is ask yourself, which version is the best documented? Which version is the most authoritative? And which version is the most logical and scientific? Now, if Peter truly does have the, quote, "the more established prophetic word," unquote, and if Peter did, in fact, recognize Paul as having, quote, "divine wisdom," unquote, then the writings of these two apostles should be the most reliable account of this resurrection story. Now, we know that Paul's writings are the earliest statements on resurrection in all of the Christian scriptures. And as far as documentation is concerned, the earliest original manuscript copies of Paul's writings in Greek date from about the year 200. This makes the writings of Paul some of the oldest Christian manuscripts that still exist. Now, what do we know about Luke, the supposed author of the gospel that bears his name? We know that Luke was not one of Jesus' chosen apostles. In fact, he never met Jesus. He never heard Jesus speak. Peter doesn't mention Luke at all, and no one else refers to him as having any kind of authority. Now, some people would say that Luke was supposedly a disciple of Paul, but you can ask yourself, if this is the case, why does he contradict Peter and Paul's teachings. Or does he? Was this passage originally a part of Luke's gospel, or was it added later? It's kind of hard to know for certain. I did some research on this, and I checked the manuscripts in Greek, and I found that the oldest manuscript copy of the 24th chapter of Luke dates from sometime after the year 1000 AD. Now, we know that Luke was not Jewish. In fact, he was born and raised in a Greek culture. And frankly, this passage from his gospel seems to be more of a reflection of Greek religious ideas than anything that can be found in the writings of Peter and Paul. Now, I want to digress here for a moment and add that the Baha'i writings do quote other passages from the Gospel of Luke. So if indeed this statement of Luke's about the fleshly resurrection of Jesus is true, if it was a mistranslation or if it was a misunderstanding, we have to remember that other passages of Luke are quoted in the Baha'i writings, so that we can assume that if there are mistakes in Luke, that it's not the entire book, it's just certain sections. Now, this also brings up the interesting question. If Luke was Greek, and if the Christian church developed primarily in a Greek and a Roman matrix, in a Greek and Roman context, to what extent did Greek and Roman culture and religious ideas influence the development of early Christian theology? To begin, we can ask, what did the Greeks and Romans believe about resurrection? Now, previously, I have quoted the writings of Justin Martyr, who has been previously identified as one of the founding fathers of the church. Now, Justin gives us a kind of a surprising insight into the Christian concept of resurrection, how it had developed by the time of the second century. Now, Justin had written a letter to Caesar, and he is trying to get Caesar to back off on some of the persecutions of the Christians. Now, the Christians were not being persecuted because they were following some weird new religion or because they were part of Judaism. The Romans were persecuting Christians because the Romans thought that Christians were atheists. So in this letter to Caesar, Justin is trying to prove to Caesar that Christians are not atheists. Now, in his letter to Caesar, Justin demonstrates the surprising similarities which had developed between the Roman gods and the Roman concept of the religion of Jesus. Justin Martyr wrote, quote, "When we say also that the Word, who is the first birth of God, was produced without sexual union, and that he, Jesus Christ, our teacher, was crucified and died and rose again and ascended into heaven, we propound nothing different from what you believe regarding those whom you esteem as sons of Jupiter." Now, can you begin to see what Justin is doing here? He's comparing Jesus, the Son of God, with the various sons of Jupiter. As you know, the sons of Jupiter were the gods who constituted the religion of the Romans. Now, Justin continues, quote, "For you know how many sons your esteemed writers ascribe to Jupiter. Mercury, the interpreting word and teacher of all. Aesculapius, who, although he was a great physician, was struck by a thunderbolt and so ascended into heaven. And Bacchus, too, after he had been torn limb from limb. And Hercules, when he had committed himself to the flames to escape his toils. And the sons of Leda and Dioscuri. And Perseus, son of Danae,
And Bellerophon, who though sprung from mortals, rose to heaven astride the horse Pegasus? And what of the emperors who die among yourselves, whom you deem worthy of deification, and in whose behalf you produce someone who swears that he has seen the burning Caesar rise to heaven from the funeral pyre? Augustus continues, he says, and what kind of deeds are recorded in each of these reported sons of Jupiter, the sons of God? It is needless to tell those who already know. This only shall be said, that they are written for the advantage and encouragement of youthful scholars, for all reckon it an honorable thing to imitate the gods. So Justin Martyr is comparing Jesus to the Greek and Roman gods, and he's demonstrating that the life of Jesus was identical to the lives of the Greek and Roman gods. And he concludes here by saying, for all reckon it an honorable thing to imitate the gods. This statement is found again in the Ante-Nicene Fathers, Volume 1, the First Apology of Justin, page 170. That's A-N-T-E, Nicene Fathers. This means the founding fathers before the Council of Nicaea, before the 3rd century. Now, in this letter, Justin offers the people of our time a unique insight into the Roman religious mind. And Justin helps us to understand how the pagan Romans would have viewed the Christian doctrines contained in the Apostles' Creed. According to Justin, like Jesus, the Roman gods were also believed to be the sons of God, or in this case, the sons of Jupiter. They too had suffered in various ways, and they too had been killed. Now this is where the story gets interesting. The Roman gods were also believed to have been resurrected from the dead, and they were also believed to have ascended into heaven, or in this case, they had ascended to Mount Olympus. Now Justin concludes his letter by telling Caesar that, quote, we propound nothing different from what you believe, unquote, and that all reckon it an honorable thing to imitate the gods, unquote. Now this is the surprising logic that this prominent second century Christian used to refute the Roman charges that Christians were atheists. Now to be fair to Justin, it should also be mentioned that he did tell Caesar that even though there were similarities between the gods, the Roman gods, and Jesus, in Justin's opinion, only the stories about Jesus were true. In addition, he also stated that although the death and resurrection stories of the Roman gods were centuries older than Jesus, Justin believed that these other accounts were produced by what he called demons. I don't know how reliable this theology is, but keep in mind that this letter was not written by an enemy of Christianity. Quite the opposite. It was written by one of the founding fathers of the church. Now, Justin had written this letter in an effort to alleviate the sufferings of his beloved fellow Christians. He would never have done anything which, to his mind, would harm or in any way compromise his religion. In fact, when he later was forced to make the choice whether to renounce his Christianity or to forfeit his life, Justin chose to give his life. According to tradition, Justin was killed in the Roman Colosseum, possibly being torn apart by wild animals. Now the question still remains, to what extent did the Roman religions influence the early development of Christian theology? How many of their interpretations and practices were eventually adopted by the early Christians? Could this have been one of the places where false teachers imported disastrous heresies into Christianity? Now, while all the details surrounding this controversy may never be known, the fact remains that this passage from the Gospel of Luke certainly seems to be more of a reflection of pagan Roman beliefs than anything that can be found in the Orthodox writings of Peter and Paul. So once again, we have to ask ourselves, who are we to believe? Peter and Paul, or whoever is responsible for this fleshly literal account found in the Gospel of Luke?
Personally, after considering all the facts, I feel that the wise choice would be to trust Peter and Paul. Now, to continue with this commentary on the articles of faith found in the Apostles' Creed, we found the next statement says that after Jesus died, he descended into hell. Quote, descended into hell. Before Jesus ascended into heaven, he first descended into hell. Now, where did this idea come from? It apparently doesn't come from the Jews. In Judaism, there is a concept of hell, or as they call it, Gehenna. However, there are no stories of people returning from there. On the other hand, once again, the Roman pagan religions contain many stories of their mythological gods and heroes descending into hell only to later triumphantly emerge alive and well. Now, this doctrine, this Christian doctrine, very possibly may have been inspired by one of the non-biblical Christian books, such as the Gospel of Nicodemus. The Gospel of Nicodemus relates a detailed account of Jesus' exploits in hell. And it says that, quote, he kicked down the gates of hell, bound Satan, and led out Adam by the hand. Abel, Abraham, Moses, and David, and Solomon were also released. Now, there are statements from the writings of Peter and Paul which seem to imply that Jesus descended into hell. For example, in Peter's writings, we can read, quote, the gospel was preached to the dead, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh, but might live according to God in the Spirit. 1 Peter 4:6. And in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, Paul asks, quote, what does he ascended mean, except that he also descended to the lower earthly regions? Ephesians 4:9. Now, the doctrine of Jesus' descent into hell that is found in the Apostles' Creed certainly does seem to have somewhat of a scriptural foundation. But is this the way that these passages were originally intended to be interpreted? Now, if Jesus' resurrection and ascension were to be interpreted literally in a fleshly manner, then wouldn't it also be consistent to conclude that his descent into hell was also a literal fleshly occurrence? This would obviously mean that somewhere in Israel, probably somewhere around Jerusalem, there is a tunnel that leads directly to hell. Now, considering all the, quote, hellfire, unquote, smoke and brimstone, unquote, that are found in some of the descriptions in the New Testament, the hellfire, smoke and brimstone in hell, I would think that this tunnel would be relatively easy to locate. All we'd have to do is find where all the smoke is coming from, and there we'd have it, the entrance to hell. That's silly. When this doctrine is viewed literally, we can see that it not only is totally inconsistent with Peter and Paul's teachings, it's not scientific. And yet somehow this is what the early church taught, that Jesus literally descended into hell. Now, the next doctrine listed in the Apostles' Creed states that after Jesus died, quote, descended into hell, unquote, and was resurrected, he then, quote, ascended into heaven and sitteth on the right hand of God the Father, unquote. Now, what did the Apostles teach concerning Jesus' ascension into heaven? Now, before we can understand how they viewed this doctrine, we first need to consider a few more statements from the writings. Now, the Apostle Paul tells us in two of his letters that Jesus ascended into heaven to prepare a place for his faithful followers. We can find this in 2 Corinthians 5 and Philippians 1:23. Then, in Paul's letter to the Ephesians and in several other places, he informs us that Jesus ascended into heaven and sits, quote, at the right hand of God. This is also found in Mark 16:19, Ephesians 1:20, Hebrews 1:3. So
So far, that's not too difficult to visualize. Jesus ascended into heaven and he sits at the right hand of God. Now ask yourself this, what do the apostles tell us about God? In Colossians, Paul tells us that Christ, quote, is the image of the invisible God. That's in Colossians 1:15. In the Gospel of John, we are told that God is a spirit, John 4:24. So we know that God is invisible and that God is a spirit, a pneuma. In other words, God is not physical. Can you begin to see what Peter and Paul and John were saying here? Jesus died physically, was resurrected spiritually, he ascended into heaven and sits at the right hand of God. Now here's the key. God is an invisible spirit, and if we can believe Paul's statement that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, then obviously fleshly bodies cannot ascend into the invisible spiritual realm of God. Therefore, according to these statements, the ascension of Jesus into heaven could not possibly have been a literal fleshly occurrence. Once again, Jesus' ascension into heaven was spiritual. Now, if we compare these ideas with the Baha'i Writings, once again, we find that the Baha'i Writings agree with these interpretations. They tell us that, quote, Jesus' resurrection from the interior of the earth is symbolical. It is a spiritual and divine fact and not material. And likewise, his ascension to heaven is a spiritual and not material ascension, which is the meaning of the resurrection of Christ. And this was a true resurrection. But as the clergy have neither understood the meaning of the Gospels nor comprehended the symbols, therefore it has been said that religion is in contradiction to science, and science in opposition to religion, as, for example, this subject of the ascension of Christ with an elemental body to the visible heaven is contrary to the science of mathematics. But when the truth of this subject becomes clear and the symbol is explained, science in no way contradicts it, but on the contrary, science and the intelligence affirm it. This is from the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, Semester Questions, page 10. So if flesh and blood cannot ascend into the invisible spiritual realm of God, then obviously Jesus' ascension into heaven had to have been a spiritual and not, as Abdu'l-Bahá said, a material occurrence. Now, up until this point, all the events which have been described in the Apostles' Creed have all happened in the past. Jesus died, he descended into hell, he was resurrected, and he ascended into heaven. Now, the final doctrine from the Apostles' Creed foretells an event which is still yet to happen. The Apostles' Creed next promises that Jesus will, quote, come to judge the quick and the dead. The return of Christ, or as Jesus called it, the coming of the Son of Man, is one of the most eagerly anticipated events in Christianity. Christians have been hoping and praying for centuries that they will be the generation which will witness the coming of the Lord from heaven. Now, there are many statements in the New Testament writings which describe what the return of Christ is going to be like. One of the best known is from the 24th chapter of Matthew, where Jesus' disciples asked him, "What will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age?" I'd like to digress here a little bit. The original Greek word for the sign of your coming, which was translated the sign of your coming, is parousia. And the actual definition of the word parousia is the return of your presence, the return of the presence. And I know some translations say the end of the world. In the original Greek, the word is aeon, which is age. So the actual correct translation of this passage from the 24th chapter of Matthew would probably be, "What is the sign of the return of your presence and of the end of the age?" Now, Jesus' first response to this question from his disciples was, interestingly enough, a warning that they not be deceived. Jesus said, quote, "Take heed that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and they will lead many astray." Now Jesus continues to predict that wars, famines, and earthquakes will characterize this era. And then he again warns that, quote, "many will fall away, and many false prophets will arise and lead many astray." This is in Matthew 24:10. Jesus says that many will, quote, "fall away." Now Jesus continues by predicting that this will be a time of, quote, "great tribulation," unquote. And then one more time, he again warns that, quote, "false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect." Matthew 24:24. Now, in these passages, we can see where Jesus warned that many Christians will fall away and that they will be led astray. Now, in Paul's second letter to the Thessalonians, we can see that he also predicted that a great, quote, "falling away" will characterize the church before Christ again, quote, "comes down from heaven," unquote. Now, speaking of the time when Christ returns, Paul warns, quote, "Let no one deceive you or beguile you in any way, for that day will not come except the apostasy comes first. That is, unless the predicted great falling away of those who have professed to be Christians has come. So then, brethren, stand firm and hold fast to the tradition and instructions which you were taught by us, whether by our word of mouth or by letter." That's in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 15. In this case, quoted from the Amplified New Testament. Now, Paul says here that a great, quote, "falling away" of those who profess to be Christians, unquote, will characterize Christianity in the days before Christ's return. In another place, in his first letter to the Thessalonians, Paul restates this warning, this time in different words. Here he says that Christians will be asleep and dead when the Lord returns from heaven. He wrote, quote, "But I do not want you to be ignorant, brothers." By the way, it's an interesting fact that at least 10 separate times in his letters, Paul implies that we are ignorant, that we weren't somehow quite grasping what he was saying. And this is especially important when we remember Peter's statement that, quote, "ignorant Christians were misinterpreting Paul's writings." To continue this quote about the return of Christ, Paul states, quote, "But I do not want you to be ignorant, brothers, concerning those who sleep. The Lord himself shall come down from heaven, and the dead in Christ will rise again. Then we who remain alive will be caught up together to a meeting with the Lord in the air. And so we will always be with the Lord. So then comfort each other with these words." That's in 1 Thessalonians 4. Now let's take a closer look at each one of these statements point by point. First, what were Paul's concerns as he was writing his two letters to the Thessalonians? What did he mean when he spoke of Christians who were asleep or dead? What did he mean when he spoke of a great falling away? To understand what Paul was saying in these passages, let's see what he meant when he made similar statements about the people back in his day. Now remember that the Jewish people of Paul's era had failed to recognize the fulfillment of their prophecies. By failing to recognize the return of Elijah, as John the Baptist, and by rejecting Jesus as their Messiah, they demonstrated that they had lost the true spirit of the Jewish teachings. Now both Jesus and Paul considered these people to be spiritually blind, asleep, or dead. Now these dead people were raised from their spiritual deadness only when they awoke to the fact that their Messiah had come. Now referring to these newly awakened Jews, Paul wrote, quote, "A few have recognized Jesus as the Messiah, but the eyes of the others have been blinded." This is what our scriptures refer to when they say that God has put them to sleep, shutting their eyes and ears, so that they do not understand what we are talking about when we tell them of Christ. It is even more wonderful when the Jews come to Christ. It will be like dead people coming back to life. This is found in Romans 11, 7 and 15. This translation, the Living Bible, the Catholic edition. Now, even though these Jewish people were physically alive, Paul considered them to be spiritually dead. They had, as Paul stated, died and been dragged down to hell and didn't even realize it. But when they awoke to the fact that their Messiah had come, they demonstrated that they had, quote, come back to life, and that they no longer were blind, that they now could see. Now there are many other symbolic references to sleep, death, awakening, resurrection, and rebirth in the New Testament writings. For example, back in the letter that Paul wrote to the Christians of Rome, he told them, quote, "It is now the hour for you to be roused from sleep." Romans 13:11. Now we can see that Paul is not telling these Christians to be aroused from physical sleep, because in the same letter he also tells them to start acting like they are alive. He wrote, quote, "Yield yourselves unto God as those who are alive from the dead." Romans 6:13. In another place, Jesus advised one of his followers to, quote, "Let the dead bury their dead." This is in Luke 9:60. And then in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, and Paul was speaking to Christians who obviously were very much physically alive, and yet Paul told them to, quote, "Wake up, O sleeper, rise from the dead." Ephesians 5:14. Now, as stated earlier, the Apostle Peter similarly wrote that, quote, "The gospel was preached also to them who are dead, that they might live according to God in the Spirit," according to God in the Pneuma. It's in 1 Peter 4:6. Now, if Peter was referring to people who are physically dead, then this would mean that he was saying that the gospel was preached to dead people in an attempt to convince them to rise from their deadness. Now, when viewed literally, this statement doesn't make very much sense. However, when it is spiritually discerned, then we can clearly see that Peter was referring to people who were dead in the spirit, and that he was encouraging them to rise from their spiritual deadness, to wake up to the fact that the Messiah had already come, and to start living the life that Jesus wanted them to live. Now, while Peter and Paul both advised people to rise from the dead, Jesus told them to get born. Jesus said, quote, "I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. That which is born of flesh is flesh, and that which is born of spirit is spirit. Marvel not that I say unto thee, ye must be born again." John 3, verses 3, 6, and 7. "That which is born of flesh is flesh, that which is born of the sark, and that which is born of spirit is spirit."
the pneuma. Jesus was talking about being reborn spiritually. Now, returning back to Paul's statements in 1 Thessalonians again, we can clearly see from the context of his remarks that Paul also intended these passages to be interpreted spiritually. Only six verses later, Paul concludes his statement about, quote, those who sleep, by advising, quote, so then we should not sleep as the rest also do. 1 Thessalonians 5:6. Now, if these promises in 1 Thessalonians were intended to be interpreted literally, then this would mean that Paul doesn't want Christians to ever physically sleep again. This isn't very realistic. In fact, it's physically impossible. In Matthew 8:24, it says that even Jesus had to sleep. Obviously, these are metaphors. They're allegories, they're symbolic, they're spiritual. And they're used to describe a spiritual condition. Jesus, Peter, and Paul were not referring to literal sleep and reawakening, or to physical birth and death. Instead, they obviously were urging people to wake up from their spiritual lethargy, to rise from the spiritual dead, to open their eyes to spiritual realities, and to start viewing these doctrines with the eye of the Spirit. Now, having noticed that Paul's comments from the book of Romans about the Jews waking up and coming back to life are virtually identical to his statements from 1 Thessalonians about the Christians who are asleep and dead. Apparently, Paul is telling us here in 1 Thessalonians that by the time Jesus does return, the warnings about false teachers and, as Paul called it, the predicted great falling away of those who profess to be Christians, unquote, will already have become a reality. Paul is apparently telling us that like the Jews of the past, Christians in the day of Christ's return will likewise have become spiritually, quote, asleep, and, quote, spiritually dead. Now we can begin to understand what Paul meant when he wrote of Christians who, quote, who sleep, and the dead Christians who arise again. Paul apparently was saying that these two will need to wake up and rise from the dead before they can recognize the Lord when he comes. Now, I would like to begin to explore the idea of the Lord returning in a little bit more detail. Now, not many Christians seriously believe that Jesus and his apostles were talking about them in these passages. Few Christians expect that they could ever become so blind that they could fail to recognize the return of Christ. However, as we have already seen, Jesus repeatedly tells us that when the time comes, quote, many of his followers will be caught asleep and unprepared. Jesus emphasizes this point even more forcefully in his parable of the 10 virgins. Now, this parable is the story of 10 maidens who are waiting for their bridegroom to come and to marry them. But Jesus tells us that half of these virgins were wise because they had come prepared by bringing enough oil to light their lamps. He also tells us that the others were foolish because they didn't bring enough oil. Now Jesus continues this parable by telling his listeners that all of the virgins fell asleep while they were waiting. And when, quote, the bridegroom, unquote, finally came, and when it was finally time for those who were waiting to wake up, the foolish ones were left, quote, blind in the dark, while the, quote, wise ones, who had come prepared with the oil of insight to light their search, the wise ones were taken, quote, in with him to the marriage.
Now Jesus continues. He says that the foolish ones who had been left outside in the dark also wanted to join the wedding festivities. But because they weren't prepared, they were left outside in the dark. And when they asked to be admitted to the wedding, the bridegroom tells them, quote, "Verily I say unto you, I know you not." They were rejected by the very one that they thought that they were going to marry. Now, the parable of the 10 virgins is a warning to be prepared, to be alert, and to be seeking. Can you see what Jesus was trying to tell us? In the past, when Jesus, the quote bridegroom, appeared to the Jews didn't have the oil of spiritual perception, which would have allowed them to recognize him as the Messiah. As a result, they were left in the dark, and their spiritual blindness prevented them from joining the wedding. Now, recognizing the fulfillment of the Jewish prophecies was very difficult in the past. And here Jesus is saying that the recognition of the Promised One, the Son of Man, this time, will not be as easy as many Christians today have been led to believe. He's warned that even though his followers will be earnestly waiting for the coming of the Promised One, many too will become so blind, misdirected, and unprepared that they too will recognize the fulfillment of their prophecies and will miss their marriage to the bridegroom. Now, despite the unmistakable warnings given by Jesus in these passages, most Christians today still feel that this just couldn't happen to them. They feel that Jesus must have been referring to someone else, that there just is no way that they could ever possibly miss the bridegroom when he appears. Jesus, however, again warns that in that day, quote, "Not everyone who saith unto me, Lord, Lord, have we not in thy name done many wonderful works? And then I will profess to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye that work iniquity." That's in Matthew 7:21. Isn't this a sobering thought? If the warnings that false teachers will lead many astray, have become reality, if the, quote, "very elect" of Christianity have truly already been deceived, and as warned by Paul, if the great apostasy truly has come, then Jesus' warning, "I never knew you, depart from me," becomes a real possibility. In the parable of the 10 virgins, Jesus warns that only those who are awake and those who have the oil of spiritual illumination will have enough insight to recognize the Promised One whenever, wherever, and however he chooses to appear. Paul tells us to stay awake, alive, and undeceived. He says to, quote, "stand firm and hold fast to the traditions and instructions which you were taught by us, whether by our word of mouth or by letter." And Jesus ends his parable of the 10 virgins by advising, "Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh."